Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. It's 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. With us today, as he always is, thank goodness, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. His column is in the paper on Thursdays and Sundays, and of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog online at ajc.com. Every day of the week. And in fact, we got some good stories from the Insider that we'll be talking about at some point today, Jim. Dr. Andra Gillespie, Emory University Associate Professor of Political Sciences here. So glad you could be back with us, Andra. Thanks a lot. And Todd Rehm, a Republican strategist and also the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, which is another great way to go online every day and hear what's happening in national, state, and local news. And I always like to say, because I think it's so true, Todd, I'm not sure there's any pundit who spends as much time and as much goes into as much depth with local races across the state. So thank you, too, for being here. So I acknowledge that what I'm about to say may be overstating the case a little bit. You'll all correct me if I'm wrong. I think yesterday, probably the most important story, single story to emerge yet in the 2016 presidential race. The director of the FBI, I don't have to repeat too much, said they're not going to recommend criminal charges against Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, he released a scathing report statement about her. Any argument that it was the biggest story so far?
Well, it is a big story, but I will take issue. I don't think it's going to matter. Not in this climate.
Wow.
I don't think in the end it's going to pull. You know, do you remember 25 years ago, Edwin Edwards ran against David Duke?
Yes.
The bumper sticker was
governor of Louisiana.
Yeah, the bumper sticker was vote for the crook. It's important, right?
Okay. The crook being Edwin Edwards.
Okay, this year, if we can find the bumper sticker large enough, it is vote for the extremely careless former Secretary of State. It's important.
Wow.
We're going to get into lines drawn that way.
Okay, Andra, what do you think about what Galloway just said?
I can't say that I disagree with him. I mean, I still think the most important story of the cycle is the emergence of Donald Trump. But yesterday was actually a really important day. And I think the way Comey handled the situation was Marshall-esque. I was thinking of Marbury versus Madison yesterday, when you're sort of kind of between a political rock and a hard place. You split the difference and you irritate everybody a little bit and kind of preserve yourself in the process. And I think that that's in part what Comey did. So he's not going to get in the political fray about having to force Hillary Clinton out of a race, but still acknowledges that there was stuff that she did that makes her look bad, that fits the narrative that already exists about her feeling that she's entitled and, you know, maybe slightly corrupt. But that doesn't actually, you know, so that gives the Republicans fodder, but it doesn't give them exactly what they want.
Todd Rehm, what are your feelings about this?
I'm going to agree with Dr. Gillespie that I think the emergence of Trump is a bigger story long-term.
As a narrative, absolutely. Single biggest event of the campaign, though, maybe.
But what I'd say is that this is in some ways better than if there had been an indictment, because what fuels the online conversation and what fuels a lot of voting behavior today is outrage. And this allows Republicans to be outraged or to continue to be outraged and to stoke that outrage for months to come. We're going to have congressional hearings. We're going to have the full panoply of things that you can to make this an issue and get as much free press as possible about it. In a way, if it had gone the other way, if there had been an indictment, Comey's Republican past would have been brought up and you would have ended up in the same position where nobody's changing their position. They're simply getting hardened in their foxholes.
All right. Let's do this. As we mentioned at the very start of the show, we're going to be talking to the state chairs of both the Republican and the Democratic Party to get their response. They're each going to be on the telephone with us. DeBose Porter, chairman of the Georgia Democratic Party, is on the phone with us right now. Mr. Chairman, thanks so much for joining us. I have to figure you must be a little bit pleased to hear all three of our panelists in the studio essentially say they don't think this is going to be as big a deal as some people do. What are your thoughts about the way in which Hillary Clinton was characterized yesterday in this FBI statement as being extremely careless, possibly opening a back door for our adversaries to spy on her emails and maybe develop information that could be damaging to the country?
No, I think the bottom line yesterday is they found nothing criminal that they should prosecute. Throughout the campaign, they were kept saying, when she's indicted, when this happens, as if this is an impending storm that does not exist anymore. And all the Republicans jumping on it from the Speaker right on down, they would rather be talking about anything other than Donald Trump. And I think this gives them some other place to go. But the bottom line is, it was a great day for Hillary Clinton's campaign. This is off the table now. The messiness and all the stuff people will hash over and over. But they want to talk about anything but the issues of raising minimum wage or climate change that has been, you know, Trump denies that it exists, or access to health care, or his tax policy that would put us further in debt. But they want to talk about everything but that, and now that the criminal part's off the table, we can get to those other issues.
But now, Dubose, just because of that, this is Jim Galloway here, isn't it more likely that you're going to see Comey's statement hashed and rehashed over and over and over again over the next 3 months?
By Republicans, the same way they've hashed Benghazi for months and months and months on trying to find something. The bottom line is, they kept saying she would be indicted. There's nothing to indict her over. So I think for her, it was a great day for her campaign. We can move forward because all those people who want to hash it want to talk about this rather than the real issues in the campaign and the real issues facing the country.
Chairman Porter, this is Todd Ream. I have to wonder if that's going to become the new standard, unindicted. There was a debate in DeKalb County the other day where Sharon Barnes Sutton, the Democratic incumbent, said that she obviously hadn't done anything wrong because she would have been indicted along with all the other crooks.
He said there was nothing criminal.
Well, that's a great slogan, and I think it'll fit nicely on a bumper sticker.
No. You have someone, Hillary Clinton, who has taken more licks than anybody in politics.
All right, Chairman Porter,
bring her record to the table.
All right, let me ask you, if you'll stay with us for a minute, allow us to play a clip, and then I want to come back and ask you about it and bring in the rest of the panel to look at this as well.
Sure.
So NBC News did a great favor to everybody who's paying close attention to this. They put together a tape in which they showed Hillary Clinton's statements over the last year about her email juxtaposed against what Director Comey said yesterday. And I think what we're going to hear here is the question becomes, Mr. Porter, one of credibility without regard to criminal activity. So let's listen, and then we'll come back on the other side.
I opted for convenience to use my personal email account, which was allowed.
They were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information.
I thought it would be easier to carry just one device.
She also used numerous mobile devices to send and to read email.
We went through a thorough process to identify all of my work-related emails.
The lawyers doing the sorting for Secretary Clinton in 2014 did not individually read the content of all of her emails
and deliver them to the State Department.
It's highly likely that their search missed some work-related emails.
So that the emails were immediately captured and preserved.
There was no archiving at all of her emails.
That was my obligation. I fully fulfilled it.
They deleted all emails they did not produce to state, and the lawyers then cleaned their devices in such a way as to preclude complete forensic recovery.
There were no security breaches.
It is possible that hostile actors gained access.
There is no classified materials.
110 emails contained classified information at the time they were sent or received.
I'm certainly well aware of the classification requirements and did not send classified material.
Even if information is not marked classified in an email, participants who know or should know that the subject matter is classified are still obligated to protect it.
At the time, this didn't seem like an issue.
None of these emails should have been on any kind of unclassified system.
So, Chairman Porter, when you hear that back and forth, doesn't it suggest to you that Hillary Clinton misled the public throughout the last year about exactly what was happening with her email account?
No, she said a long time ago it was a mistake to do it in a private server. She would have done it differently. I think it cleared the air yesterday. Everybody's going to rehash and compare and look for these one sentence to compare. Bottom line, let's get to the issues of what people care about. And here you have someone who is Secretary of State who did a phenomenal job representing this country, and they want to find something on her email, something in Benghazi, to bring her entire record down, and I don't think that's valid.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Galloway again here.
Yes.
I know you're a Hillary Clinton supporter, but what's your sense of whether this satisfies or will defuse the Bernie Sanders contingent that's headed for Philadelphia right
well,
now?
Well, I think that will be resolved. Bernie is actively engaged himself in working on issues in the platform, which is what he's more focused and interested right now. He's going to support Hillary Clinton. He's going to support the Democratic nominee. And, you know, they still want to get everything off of Republicans, certainly want to get everything off of Trump. The same people who still believe that Barack Obama's a Muslim, that Barack Obama's not a U.S. citizen, are the same type of people who are going to fetish over this, you know, what was done yesterday.
Without
the bottom line is, it, you know, they kept holding the criminal thing over, and it doesn't exist.
Andrew, without regard, obviously Chairman Porter is staying true to his party and to his.
I believe in her.
I appreciate that.
She's the most qualified person to have ever run for president.
Okay.
And I think they're trying to work on her credibility, which I don't think it'll work because I know she would be better for this country. She'd be better for Georgia.
Andra, we assume that the people who have decided are going to divide into their two camps on this. The people who are going to vote for Trump are going to stick with Trump. The people who are determined to support Hillary Clinton, as Jim Galloway suggested, they're not going to care as much. But what about all of the undecided voters out there and what impact this could have on the undecided?
Well,
they're going to care about whether kids can go to college. Go ahead. You direct it to her.
So, you know, I think it's a big question of how many undecided people there actually are in this cycle. You know, I've seen the numbers in polls hover between 7% and 12% of the population. And so I think it's a question of, are those truly undecided people? Are those people who are deciding between voting for which of their two preferred candidates they're going to vote for and not vote at all? You know, I would expect that at least in the short term, I would not be surprised if Hillary Clinton had at least a short-term drop in the polls as a result of this week. I think a lot of this was largely baked in the cake. And questions that were asked before yesterday about Hillary Clinton's role in the email scandal, about two-thirds of Americans said that they thought that she had mishandled the situation. So I think that this only confirms what people already thought, and they've already factored that into their decision. I do think, though, that this fits a larger narrative that's been created about Hillary Clinton being dishonest, being entitled, and being reckless. And so I think that term reckless will still have ramifications going into this election cycle. And I think the potential narrative that if she had been a civil service employee of the State Department and had been caught doing what she had done, she probably wouldn't have a job, and at the very least she wouldn't have a security clearance, is an issue that will come up. I mean, there's already chatter about her not allowing her to have access to security briefings as a result of this as punishment for this, which I think is probably not going to happen. But the idea that some of her top aides who were, you know, being emailed in this scandal could lose their security clearance is a big deal, because the aides that are implicated are the long-term aides that are household names to many of us.
All right, we are going to continue. Chairman Porter, I'll give you a chance to get in a last word. We asked you to be on for a short time, and you have been, but we'll give you a last opportunity before we bring your counterpart in to talk about his perspective on this.
I'll be glad to stay with you at this point. But the bottom line is, I think it moves on now. This was the one thing that was everybody kept hanging over, and now it's gone. And the minutiae of it, people argue, certain Republicans are going to talk about this more. I think most Americans are going to move on to the real issues that affect their daily lives. How can their children get a better job than they did? What is their access to health care? Climate change and clean air and water, raising the minimum wage, that's what people care about. Hillary Clinton would be the best candidate, most qualified to get that done for America.
All right. Well, Chairman DeBose Porter of the Georgia Democratic Party, we appreciate your spending some time with us. And we do want very much to get you into the studio before the Democratic convention, which starts in just 3 weeks from now. So we're going to arrange to do that. give you more of an opportunity to talk about what you've got coming up. But thanks so much for being with us today.
Sure thing. Thanks for the chance. Good to be with y'all.
I'll tell you what, let's take a break. And when we come back, there's a lot more to discuss on this. I want to talk especially about how Georgians might feel about this. But I also think we'll get Chairman John Padgett of the Republican Party, State Republican Party, on the line. The Trump response to all this last night, if there is potential to really hurt Hillary Clinton over this, I want to hear what you all in the studio think about whether or not he's capable of making that case. We're at Politics, GPB. We've already gotten a couple of tweets in. Ted Barfield says, I doubt Trump will be able to capitalize on the FBI report. It would require tact and discipline. And, well, he's short on both. That's just one of the things we're going to talk about. This is Political Rewind at 222. We'll be back in a moment.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. Your car can make so many sounds. Sputtering, backfiring, squeaking, grinding, if it's my car. Threats, muttered under its breath. Trade in those sounds for the sounds of public radio. Donating that unwanted car, truck, or even an RV is easy and helps the station in a big way. You may even earn a tax write-off.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR and thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, the rise of the judicial right. We talk with Linda Greenhouse, co-author of a new book about how the Supreme Court under Chief Justice Warren Burger from 1969 to 86 played a crucial role in establishing the conservative legal foundation for the even more conservative courts that followed. Greenhouse covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Welcome back to Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway is here, Republican Todd Rehm, and Dr. Andra Gillespie from Emory University. Jim Galloway, while I try to talk, we're going to talk to, I think, Chairman Padgett in a minute. He's on the phone. Chairman Padgett, you're with us.
With you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us for a short time. We just talked to DeBose Porter. I don't know if you were able to hear the conversation or not. Jim Galloway of the AJC, Todd Rehm, and Dr. Andra Gillespie from Emory are in the studio right now. Let me give you a first shot. In your statement yesterday, in response to the FBI report, you said, quote, Hillary Clinton's the most crooked and corrupt politician in American politics. Expand on that for us.
Well, let's look at what just happened in the last few days. She managed somehow to get her husband into an airplane with the attorney general for a conference immediately thereafter. Within a day or so, the FBI comes out and draws. If you listen to that report from the FBI, you heard all the way through that report. If you listen to it, you're thinking, well, any minute he's going to announce that he's going to indict her, and then he decides at the very end, his statement is that he's not going to indict her. And it all happened over a 4th of July weekend. Now, that might not prove she's the most dishonest, crooked person in politics in America, but that just goes to kind of prove a point about the way she would go about handling her opportunity if she were president of the United States.
The Trump campaign so far has not shown that they are particularly adept in this instance, as they have not been in many other instances, at focusing on a message that will reach voters about this report from FBI. How are you here in Georgia going to address this issue, and what are you going to tell our voters here about this?
Well, I'm going to tell our voters here the same thing I would do if I were Trump. I'd run an ad. And I'd have Hillary making a comment she made that she didn't, she wasn't responsible for any of this email problem. And then I'd have Comey making a response that he made yesterday indicating she was. She couldn't find emails. He found several thousand. None of them were a top secret. 110 of them were. I mean, it's just, in my opinion, it's an awful situation for Hillary Clinton to be caught in, but she can't get out of it. Her own words, the FBI's words, and it all is just a stream of things that go all the way back before Benghazi, et cetera, and you know all the talking points from my side about that.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Galloway here.
Hey, Jim.
question. How many campaigns have you run in your life? Dozens, right? Somewhere
I've been
around
involved
there?
In dozens, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When the other candidate is having a very, very bad day, what is your instruction to your candidate? It's to do nothing, or at least to help that other candidate in the, dig the hole deeper, right? I mean, the object is not to change the subject. Doesn't that frustrate? I mean, we had, Hillary Clinton, I think, probably had the worst day, even with Barack Obama on the stage with her. She had the worst day of her campaign yesterday. And then yesterday evening in Raleigh, North Carolina, you had Donald Trump start talking nice about Saddam Hussein. That's got to be frustrating.
Oh, I don't get frustrated with Republican candidates. I just listen to them and try to do the best we can do with what they bring to the table politically. So,
Mr. Chairman, let me do this. It'll give you more of a chance to respond.
And by the way, you did a really good job of explaining exactly what happened and how bad this really was for Hillary yesterday. Thank you.
Okay. So let's play two excerpts back to back. Trump last night, given a softball like no other in this political campaign to go after Hillary Clinton, went to a rally, no teleprompter, which maybe might have been a better idea, and went off for a good hour plus. I lost track of the time. And let's listen to just one example first of his being kind of on point, and then one example of where he just went off the rails and did nothing to advance his cause.
She said today that we may consider the Attorney General to go forward. That's like a bribe, isn't it? Isn't that sort of a bribe? I mean, the Attorney General sitting there saying, if I get Hillary off the hook, I'm going to have 4 more years or 8 more years. But if she loses, I'm out of a job. It's a disgrace. Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. But you know what he did well? He killed terrorists. They didn't read him the rights. They didn't talk. They were a terrorist. It was over. Today, Iraq is Harvard for terrorism. You want to be a terrorist, you go to Iraq.
So, Mr. Chairman, when you hear, and Jim Galloway referred to it too, your candidate decide to talk about Saddam Hussein in somewhat positive terms instead of Hillary Clinton, come on, that's got to be frustrating.
Well, I think he was talking about killing terrorists more than he was talking about Saddam Hussein. He just used him as an example of someone that went around, in his estimation, killing terrorists. I don't have a problem with that part of it. I think we do far too little of that under the administration that we have now. If we were killing more terrorists, we'd probably have a lot less problems in the world than we're having right now. I lay that at the feet of Obama, not at the feet of Donald Trump.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is Andra Gillespie. So I think that... I think that Bill's point was that yesterday would have been a day to hone in on the crooked Hillary meme, and it just reinforced that over and over and over again, and maybe even pivot a little from crooked to reckless. And so, I understand, given all of the events that happened with ISIS last week, why he would want to focus on terrorism, but it doesn't seem particularly nimble for him to go back to terrorism on this particular day and then to do so in such a way that he, ends up kind of lauding in some way one of our most hated enemies of the last 20 years.
Well, I don't know what his plans are when he makes a speech. He doesn't give me a buzz to check me out about it. But I am pretty well convinced that you're going to hear a lot about Hillary and what happened over the last weekend and the weeks and months to come.
All right, let's get Todd Riemann.
We'll just stay tuned. Hey, Todd.
Hey, Chairman Padgett, how are you doing?
I'm fine, sir. Thank you.
In 2014, everybody was talking about how Georgia was due to go purple, and we're hearing that again. In that year, the Georgia Republican Party put on an unprecedented ground game statewide. Do you anticipate doing the same type of stuff in 2016, and are we going to see that kind of effort with both the presidential election and Johnny Isaacson on the ballot?
Yeah, except we'll do a better job, and it was extraordinary. We managed to beat a guy down in Augusta that hadn't been beatable, and we beat him pretty bad, John Barra, who's now retired, which aggravates me immensely, back to Athens. He didn't stay in Augusta, moved back to my hometown. And I made a statement many, many times. I've been trying to beat him for 35 years, and sort of at the end of my career, we got him.
But we won that race. We won every other race that you could win as a Republican in Georgia, all the way down the ticket. And I won't say we won them handily, but we beat the Democrats pretty bad. I was really surprised it raised a little blue heads up much in this campaign season, but it looks like we're going to have to go back and do it again. And we'll do basically the same kind of job that we did and use the same kind of strategy that we used 2 years ago. It'll change over the years what we're going to have to do, but for right now, we'll probably just do basically the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just change the topic just ever so slightly.
Sure.
We got a note late yesterday from a fellow named Bobby Booth of Marietta. He's a delegate to Cleveland. He's very, very religious, and he sent us a statement that said, not only can he not vote in any circumstance for Donald Trump, but was going to start working against him. Is that, I mean, there are 76 delegates and 76 alternates in the group that's headed up that way. Is he a lone wolf, or is there a broader is there a broader contingent that we don't know of?
Well, there may be a few more, but look, there's a whole lot of folks that are going up there that wouldn't vote for Ted Cruz now either. So, I'm not sure.
And he was a Ted Cruz supporter.
And there may be some of that. But look, we're not going to get any major rules changes. If we get any rules changes that actually affect the convention, we're going to go to Thursday. We're going to have one vote. We're going to elect Donald Trump to be the nominee of the Republican Party for president in this election. And I think most of the dissatisfaction and most of the negative yakking from Republicans, not only in what little bit there may be in my delegation, but some of the folks across the country that are elected Republicans, I think you're going to see go away. As long as people hold out the hope that I'm going to get Ted as my nominee or I'm going to get Marco as my nominee, you're going to have some of that, but it'll be over after the first vote.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead. Finish your thought.
This next week.
Mr. Chairman, we really appreciate you taking a few minutes to be with us on Political Rewind. Come back. We'd love to have you on the show. One of these days, have you in the studio.
All you got to do is ask. Glad to come back anytime.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chairman John Padgett of the Republican Party of Georgia. Todd Ream, let's dig deeper into this whole notion of Trump's ability or lack of ability to stay on message and what it does in the long run to whether or not he can do any genuine damage to Hillary Clinton.
Well, I think there's two parts to that. One is that in terms of his personal communications, I am not sure who you would say is qualified to coach him or who he would say and accept coaching from. I don't think we're going to get a short leash on Trump anytime soon. That may be fine because the other part of it, the mass communications part of it, is probably going to be left to other people this year. And it's one thing for the candidate to say something, and it's one of the it's been a two-edged sword for Trump that he can get as much free TV time as he wants just by opening his mouth somewhere. That he gets a lot of coverage and he got a lot of mileage in the primary system, but it also means there's always a camera running. And so we've just given up on policing that. But I think in terms of staying on message, what you will see is you will see, as it's been discussed, that a lot of the normal campaign mechanics are going to be taken over by both the RNC and by some of the super PACs, that those folks are going to be willing and able to maintain a disciplined message.
Andre Gillespie, as we watch this unfold, talk about this. We've known for quite some time that the voters in this country are not particularly happy with the choices they are going to make in November. NBC polling the other day had 61% of the people essentially saying they can't stand where this race is headed. So, but bring it back to Georgia. Is Georgia in fact a purple state in the fall election? And is it Trump talking about Saddam Hussein and other things that don't really have anything to do with policy? Or is it Clinton being revealed to have not told the truth over and over about her emails that are going to have more resonance here?
So I'm always skeptical of the Georgia is a purple state thing. And I mean, even when we say that Georgia is a purple state, we're talking about the Republican candidate winning by a 7 to 9 point margin. We're not talking about 2 to 3 point margins. And I doubt that that would even happen in this particular race. But I think the DPG is hoping for is that Donald Trump is an alarming enough candidate that it can rouse enough Democratic voters out to narrow that gap, and that there are some Republican voters that are turned off enough that they will at least not vote at the top of the ticket race. I mean, and so, you know, if we had Chairman Padgett still here, my question to him would be, how concerned about you about the down ticket races, not the Senate race per se, but what kind of negative effect could this have further down the ticket? And I think that, you know, there's this larger implication that if the discipline, if the GOTV effort is outsourced to the party, and in particular to super PACs, how ready are super PACs to be able to bear that role? Clearly, they've got the money to be able to do it, but they haven't really sort of been in the position yet where they've been doing a lot of hardcore GOTV yet. So their operation might not be completely up to snuff yet.
I'm going to do two things. I'm going to first answer the question about the down ballot races. And I would say that my job is to be nervous about those down ballot races because that's the bulk of my clients. And I am going to sleep every night between now and the election on the basis of that, yeah. Because the Democratic Party of Georgia didn't even field a candidate for the other statewide spot on the ballot. But beyond that, there are probably 4, maybe 5 legislative seats that are capable of changing party.
I would say 4 House seats, maybe a couple Senate seats.
I would say 1 Senate seat.
Which Senate seat?
I would say Senate District 43, which
out in Conyers,
which was taken by a Republican in a special election last year. But other than that, you know, your total downside is 4 seats in the state house, and so you're down to 116, 115. Yeah. I'm not losing sleep.
But Jim Galloway, that has certainly less to do with whether Trump is a boost or a drag on the ticket, and more to do with the fact that the state Democratic Party doesn't have any strength, any bench strength for sure at this point.
Well, they've got bench strength. They just haven't found it yet. It's somewhere out there, but they haven't gotten them into office. You got to get it. You know, you got to play minor league before you can play in the majors, and that's what this whole hope has been. When they've calling Georgia a purple state is all about wishful thinking. You are praying that the presidential candidate will agree with you and pump millions of dollars into the state to help you identify voters, to help you with turnout. And so far, we have not seen Hillary Clinton, and I don't think we are.
Yeah.
To Andre's point about the ability of the RNC and the super PACs to pick up the slack, the great thing about Trump not needing coaches and consultants is that all those great coaches and consultants are available today. But the other thing is that as a party, we as Republicans are going to have to spend some time around the campfire thinking about and probably discarding part of what we think we know about our own electorate. Mm-hmm. Because I think one of the great lessons of Donald Trump is that the Republican Party is not what people like me thought it was. Right. I grew up in a Republican Party that was, by and large, middle management, professional, and up. And Donald Trump has tapped into a working class angst that we didn't realize because there are cognitive biases that made us think that all the people voting in Republican primaries believe in free trade and they believe in this and they believe in all the other stuff that those of us weaned on Republican philosophy have taken for granted. And that's not where the Republican Party really is.
All right. So let's talk about that a little bit. And let me introduce it this way, Andra. Patty Shellhas just tweeted us, still your focus is smug condescension of Trump rather than tears for loss of freedom by the VIPs who are allowed to live above the laws, meaning obviously the Clintons in this case. But Andra Gillespie, you know, just taking what she said there, I don't know that we're really being smugly condescending. I think we're pointing out that Trump has a hard time focusing on one message, but I'll take her, you know, fine, take that criticism. Right. But when I hear the Trump trade message, without regard to whether he's able to use the Clinton FBI report against her, boy, the trade message that he settled on is awfully powerful. And I think if they stick with that, I think it does them some good, especially in some big states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, maybe Wisconsin, West Virginia, yes?
So, you know, I don't disagree with you there. I mean, I think that that's part of the reason why Trump has cultivated the appeal that he has. But I think it's the mechanics and it's the details of these plans that I don't think people are interrogating enough. And so if that makes me smug and condescending to question your trade policy or what the long-term impacts would be, I think that's fine. It was funny when I was reading Jim's article about trade, one of the things that struck me was that we had this transition away from a manufacturing and based economy to a service-based economy, but there wasn't a wide-scale plan to help workers transition into that new economy. And so that's why you get that resistance today. I don't think you can stop the globalization train. It's gone. There's nothing that you can do about it. But I think the lesson that hopefully the elites take from this is that you have to prepare constituents in order to be able to compete in that. And we just didn't do that. We left a lot of people behind, and now we have the backlash.
Yeah, Jim, I think if you would spend a minute summarizing for us the column, you wrote a wonderful column on this last week, talking about how the Trump trade message now, which has really shut down our borders in many ways, bring jobs back to this country, is contrary to everything that the Georgia Republican leadership has been doing for the last decade here.
Right, right. He gave his speeches in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New Hampshire, areas where heavy unionized manufacturing used to be and has fled. And what he's saying is that we're going to bring those jobs back, you know, through carrots and sticks, a lot of sticks. But the problem is that doesn't address the southern economy. I mean, we had our manufacturing base, textile mills. When we lost them, we didn't go after them. We didn't want to bring them back. That we wanted something better. So you've had many several southern states kind of establish as a baseline an auto manufacturing. Foreign auto manufacturers come in. They import their parts, which are created in other places cheaply, and the cars are assembled here and moved off to U.S. consumers. That's not an economic model that's going to benefit from a trade war.
It's also not a model that is useful to a 50-year-old blue-collar person in the way that it is an 18-year-old with a blue-collar background. The 18-year-old has a lot of the stuff that Georgia is building out today in terms of the manufacturing education in the technical college system of Georgia. The 50-year-old may feel that that's not open to him or her, and that retraining at this point in their career is probably just not even worth pursuing. And so what do those folks do? They get mad.
Right. So, I mean, and so, yeah, and I understand the anger. And so, and I think that it would do well for elites to understand the anger and to not just dismiss it, that it's not coming from a crazy place. But can you tell that 50-year-old worker who's been laid off, I know that you've been used to making whatever product it is this particular way, but that there are skills that you have, and if you just think about how to apply them in a different context, you might actually be able to do something that's more marketable. Or maybe do something independent where you can now be an entrepreneur. I don't think people have been shown certain types of opportunities that might actually be available with the skill set that they currently have. All they know is I made widgets and now I want to keep on making widgets. And that's just not feasible or possible.
The other problem is a lot of those widget makers are in rural Ohio and Indiana, and the new manufacturing jobs are coming to Georgia and Alabama.
Yeah, one thing I would just say is I agree with all that. In Donald Trump's speeches last week, especially the one in New Hampshire, the most worrisome thing was he was walking up to the edge with some of his language. I mean, he came very, very close. When you start talking about global financiers controlling Hillary Clinton, that's coming very, very close to a message that we heard pre-World War II.
An anti-Semitic.
An anti-Semitic.
And
one,
he was not helped by the tweet.
Right.
Which got so much attention over the weekend, again, at a point when Hillary Clinton is sitting down to be interviewed by the FBI on Saturday morning, when the Trump campaign, the Republican Party could have used that. Trump is on the spot because this tweet shows what appears to be a Jewish star, Hillary Clinton's face, piles of money behind her. And worse, the message is from Trump, it was a sheriff's badge.
No, sheriff's badges have 5 points.
Well, but it's also the sheriff's badges also usually have the little round points on the tips that will kind of help distinguish it. So even if you were going to make that claim, it's just a simple, don't put a Star of David next to a pile of money because people will start to think Shylock.
Okay.
And that's bad.
Okay. I want to ask all three of you to respond to something. Okay. Please help me with this. Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, both facing big, big troubles in the last week. Help me understand why we can't hear two things in reaction to those things. One, Trump saying, oh my gosh, I'm really sorry. We didn't realize that. Now it does turn out that imagery came from a white supremacist website, and somebody on the campaign knew that. Still, okay, Trump could have said, gee, I'm sorry. He didn't. He doubled down. And let me ask you even this question, too. And Jim, I'll give you the first crack at this. When the meeting, the airport tarmac meeting between Bill Clinton and Loretta Lynch came to light, Hillary Clinton went to lengths to say, oh, no, nothing happened. My husband said they talked about it. Seems to me one of the biggest problems Hillary Clinton has is not being a human being.
Why could she not say, what a jerk? What a doofus that was.
My husband has shown himself to be a jerk off and on over the years. Here's another example. I'm so angry. Why not? This is Andre, you're already.
I know she's got the answer.
So the answer to this one is, one, they've staked their political careers together. And so she didn't want to take him out like that. And then second, she has billed him almost as a co-president, which I find very, very problematic for the first female president. So if this is going to be a trusted key policy advisor, then she feels a certain level of loyalty to him beyond the fact that they've been married for 40 years and have one kid and two grandkids together. So, yeah, when the Monica Lewinsky story first came out and, you know, there are the rumors that she slapped him as soon as she heard about it. But you had to hear that second or third hand. She's never said, oh, my gosh, I really wanted to, like, you know, beat him up after that one. So she's not going to do it in this particular case. But yeah, you're right. It's a fail.
Hey, Todd Ream, I respect my wife so much, I can't even tell you. But every now and then I'm able to say, oh my God, you did something that was just really not the smartest thing you've ever done. I mean, I still think this humanizes her and she doesn't want to go there.
Well, I lucked out and married the perfect woman who is also occasionally a listener. But I think for her to say something like that also opens the conversation about her role in the suppression of news about the other boorish things that he has done for 20 years, and the question of did she aid and abet a serial sexual harasser.
All right. I'm sorry to cut this short, but we are way late in getting our break in. So let's do that. Clip Siegel, by the way, says that he doesn't get why Hillary Clinton is considered the most qualified, unremarkable Senate career, disastrous failure as Secretary of State. Don't see it. We have some other tweets we'll get to after the break. This is Political Rewind at 2:48.
Hundreds of U.S. and allied troops have died in Afghanistan's Helmand province. And when U.S. troops withdrew in 2014, the province was overrun by the Taliban. A year later, a new batch of U.S. Army trainers arrived.
When I got here, success was holding Helmand. Don't let Helmand fall. The first few weeks, it was rough.
The fight for Helmand later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Andre Gillespie, Todd Ream, Jim Galloway with me in the studio this afternoon. So we'll have plenty of time in the weeks ahead, certainly with the conventions coming up, to talk presidential politics. Let's talk some local politics. Todd, you sent me a note yesterday saying interesting things happening in Cobb County. That chairman's race at the runoff certainly is interesting. Talk about it.
So what happened was that Tim Lee has been, ever since he's been elected, he has created a group of folks who are just furious at him. And part of it is legitimately things he's done. Part of it is the way he goes about doing it. And it's almost like his personality sometimes is part of what creates the bad feelings. But Mike Boyce, who ran against him 4 years ago and is running against him again, came in first in the primary on May 24th with Ted Lee 9 points behind, 8 points behind, a significant disadvantage. Generally, for an incumbent county commissioner, if you're in a runoff in your own primary, you're in trouble. And I think that this could be one of the biggest political upsets in since 2002, maybe.
Jim, it really does play into the voters' anger at incumbents, doesn't it? I mean, especially this notion that they are empowered and elite. Tim Lee works the Braves deal behind closed doors. It's a perfect example of that outrage.
Yeah. There are two things here. Number one, Cobb is number one. It's the richest vein of Republican vote, so you have to remember that. It's also got this deep, longstanding division between the movement conservatives and the business community. It's always been there. Tim Lee has always been on the business side, even when he was a district commissioner. Then you have this huge Braves deal. It was almost $400 million of public money put into the new stadium that's going up right now. But, you know, when the city of Atlanta did that with the Braves Stadium, and when the state does that to bring in things like Kia and such, they do so in a very insulated manner. The Falcons deal was cut maybe, 2 years before by a vote of the General Assembly. So you know, you couldn't go to a city council person and say, I'm not going to vote for you because of this. But in Cobb County, it was a direct action by Tim Lee and the other Cobb County commissioners. So they're not insulated from this.
And I would say, to Jim's analysis, I'd say there is a third leg to the political stool in Cobb County, and that is the homeowners associations and the East Cobb Civic Association as much as anybody else, which has sometimes been on board with either movement conservatives or Chamber of Commerce types. Sometimes it's been a different path. And it was that group of folks who started Sam Olens down his path. And so for Tim Lee, it's not just the question of movement conservatives or Chamber of Commerce types. It's also having whether you've alienated a group of non-ideological neighborhood voters.
Failed to consolidate is the way I'd go.
Well, and then your newspaper, the AJC, writes a story last week that just contributes to this notion of the elitists of Cobb County. Maybe there are good reasons, by the way, for this, but I don't know. The Braves and Cobb County have decided that if you have a little business or office park and you've got 100 parking spaces there near the stadium, you're not going to be allowed. The commission is passing a statute which will forbid you from parking cars at Braves.
You have to get specific permission.
It just sounds, it's another example that it sounds like that they are just taking control away from real people in the county. Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. And I would expect that people would, you know, actually go before the county commission and actually dispute that type of ordinance and suggest how this could potentially hurt people. You know, politicians, legislators make rules all the time that don't make sense. And once things go into practice, that's when people are supposed to speak up and say, yeah, that was a good idea or not. But in practice, it's a really bad idea and you might want to go back and adjust that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it was. I would say our friend Brian Robinson would say this was the Braves' effort to really. They didn't want the gypsy lot system that you see sometimes around Turner Field.
Brian is consulting for Tim Lee in this campaign.
Yes, he is. But I thought it was significant in the AJC story. We pointed out that Ted Lighthead, who is head of the CID, the taxing district in that area, knew nothing about this ordinance.
Andre, let me turn to another subject that's got a local figure involved in national politics. We're hearing this week that there might be possible disciplinary action against John Lewis and the other House Democrats who staged their sit-in about gun violence and not getting an opportunity to vote on bills they wanted to relating to gun safety, gun control, call it what you will. Are we going to see more repercussions from this? And does it make sense for the Republican leadership there to really want to take action against these guys?
I would say that it probably wouldn't, just because I assume we're still in an era of divided party control, where party control shifts back and forth and back and forth. And if Republicans pulled this stunt when they're out of control in the future, then they need to remember what they did this particular time. So, the Republican leadership was embarrassed by that sit-in last week. They were embarrassed by how savvy Democratic staffers at least were in getting their members to put this up on Periscope when C-SPAN took it down, and it did push an issue because it at least forced some discussion of the issue, whether or not, you know, didn't go anywhere, but the fact that it actually forced a discussion. I think that, you know, in the long run, I think that somebody like Representative Lewis, you know, who has taken his lumps and been jailed in the past before, is probably not worried about, you know, getting some discipline from the House for having staged this sit-in.
No, that would be part of civil disobedience, is to accept the punishment.
Right.
And make a show of that, too. I have been talking to a few staffers and some members of Congress who suggest that, yeah, they expect this to happen again. Next time, though, Republicans might try to block the Wi-Fi and shut off the cell phone access.
Yeah, Todd, you know, so again, just in the battle of public perception, and this is what I was sort of getting at with my question to Andra, does it make sense for Republicans to want to shut down a John Lewis, who people of all political stripes would agree is one of the great heroes of contemporary American history?
My perspective is that John Lewis has earned the right to say whatever he wants, wherever he wants, in much the same way that I feel about John McCain. The problem is that for Paul Ryan or the rest of the leadership as a whole, part of their biggest angst is that they're constantly getting tagged by their own electorate, by their own commentariat, as aiding and abetting the Democrats or aiding and abetting liberal outcomes to stuff that they and so if you have a leadership that is unwilling or unable to take disciplinary action against his own party, at some point his hand is going to get forced. And if it were not for John Lewis, it's an easier question. John Lewis makes it really, really difficult.
All right, real quick, we don't have very much time. Newt Gingrich, yes or no? Is he the running mate? We're going to hear within the next week, we think.
No.
Todd?
No.
I think I'm going to lean toward no.
No. All right. Well, that's too bad, because we'd love to see our fellow Georgian Newt Gingrich on the ticket. Look, we are out of time today. We're going to talk a little bit more about Newt Gingrich on this show on Friday, because Randy Evans will be here. Randy is a longtime advisor and friend to Newt Gingrich, and he's also a key player in the Republican Convention Rules Committee. And you know, there's going to be an effort to John Padgett referred to it, to see if there's a way to come up with rules that will allow for someone else's name to be entered in nomination at the convention. Not likely, but we'll hear what Randy Evans has to say about that Friday on Political Rewind, live at 3 o'clock. Todd Rehm at georgiapundit.com. Dr. Andra Gillespie from Emory University and Jim Galloway of AJC, thank you all for being here today. So we want to welcome the newest member of the Political Rewind staff today. Our new producer, Trevor Young, is in the control room. He's at the controls, and we are so glad that you could be here, Trevor. We also are glad to have Hannah Rose Adams and Caroline Hayes, our terrific interns who contributed a lot to this show today. Thanks, both of you. And of course, the exceptional Jenny Ament, our senior producer. Thanks for all the work you're all doing for this show. I'm Bill Nigut. We will see you again Friday. Jim Galloway and I will be here to talk to Randy Evans. That should be fun, Jim.
And then on to Cleveland.
Take care. See you later.